I woke up in the early hours of the 14th of February. It was extremely warm in my room. I sat up in bed. Reva was still awake, or she was obviously not sleeping. She rolled over to me and she said, "Can't you sleep, my bubba?" And I said, "No, I can't."
That's Oscar Pistorius on the witness stand at his murder trial in 2014. He's giving his version of what happened the night he killed Reva Steenkamp. After waking up, Pistorius said he noticed two fans had been left in the doorway to the balcony. He got up and moved them back into the room. Then, he said he heard a noise coming from the bathroom.
Sounded like the window sliding open. That's the moment that everything changed. I thought that there was a burglar that was gaining entry into my home. I grabbed my firearm from underneath the bed and I whispered for Reva to get down and phone the police.
Pistorius was going to confront this intruder himself. He began to creep down a passage toward the bathroom, gun in hand.
It was at that point that I was just overcome with fear and I started screaming and shouting for the burglar or the intruders to get out of my house. I shouted for Reva to get out on the floor. I shouted for her to phone the police.
At one point, Pistorius also heard a door inside the bathroom slam shut. Now, Pistorius' bathroom was rather large. It's like a full room, with a separate cubicle for the toilet. He said that when he got there, the toilet door was closed.
I wasn't sure if somebody was going to come out to the toilet to attack me. So I just stayed where I was and I kept on screaming. And then I heard a noise from inside the toilet. What I perceived to be somebody coming out of the toilet. Before I knew it, I'd fired four shots at the door.
This was the core of Pistorius' defense. He thought there was an intruder in his house, and he tried to protect himself.
Now, when you were standing with your firearm pointing to the toilet door, what emotions did you experience?
I was terrified. I feared for my life. I was just scared. I was thinking about what could happen to me and to Reva. I was just extremely fearful, overcome with a sense of terror and vulnerability.
But here's the thing. Listening to Pistorius, lots of South Africans recognized what he was really saying. They knew there was a coded meaning behind his words.
So when Oscar Pistorius says that he was afraid that the person in the bathroom was an intruder, everybody understands that that intruder has a race, and that race of that intruder is black.
That's South African author Sisonke Umsamong.
Oscar was trying to hide behind the idea of the mythic black intruder.
The mythic black intruder. The racist stereotype that black people are a constant threat to invade your home. It's a fear that's largely baked into the history of South Africa, going back to apartheid, and it continues, in some form, to this very day. When Oscar Pistorius appeared to invoke this fear in his defense, some people thought he was using it as an excuse, a cover-up, but others actually bought into his story. They identified with this fear, this anxiety he said he felt. In this episode, we're going to try to better understand this story that Pistorius told on the witness stand and why it's still so polarizing in South Africa today. From Religion of Sports and PRX, this is False Idol. I'm Tim Rowan. From CBC Podcasts comes an all-new investigative show, hosted by award-winning investigative journalist Maggie Rahr. Carrie Lowe trusted police when she reported her horrific assault, but she says they failed to investigate properly and only succeeded in traumatizing her further. Now, she's setting out on a mission to hold these institutions to account. Listen to Carrie Lowe Versus everywhere you get your podcasts. The first day Pistorius took the witness stand, Barry Rue, his defense attorney, asked him questions about his upbringing and the environment in which he was raised. Pistorius's parents separated when he was young, and he spent much of his youth living with his mother, Sheila, along with his brother and sister. Sheila was essentially a single mother, raising three kids on her own.
Your mother, did she have any security concerns?
My mother had a lot of security concerns. We obviously grew up in a family where my father wasn't around much. We didn't stay in the best of suburbs, and there was often crime in the area. So my mother, she would often get scared at night, and she would phone the police, but more than often than not, it was just her being scared. And so she would come, you know, at night and call us to go sit in her room, and many times we'd just wait for the police to arrive.
Pistorius's mother was so afraid, she slept with a gun near her bed. According to Pistorius, his mother's fears weren't always unfounded. He said that his mother's house was actually broken into on several occasions. They didn't have much, so the intruders stole things like TVs and VCRs. Pistorius recalled one time in particular when his father's house was ransacked.
One of the intruders or burglars had cut his hand, I think, and he'd wiped the blood all over the wall, and they had pulled a safe out of the house using a motor vehicle. They'd cut all the sofas open and all the mattresses open, and basically the whole house had been destroyed.
But what was missing from these stories was the historical context around them. Pistorius was born in the mid-80s, when apartheid was still going on. During apartheid, the country was run by white nationalists, a group largely comprised of people called Afrikaners. But the vast majority of the population was black, and the Afrikaners lived in constant fear of black people retaliating and rising up against them. There's even an Afrikaans term for this, swart gevaar. It roughly translates to black danger.
So swart gevaar is a term that was used frequently during the apartheid era, and it really referred to this perceived security threat of the black majority population and what that meant to the white population.
Sasanke Umsamong again.
It was used often to invoke the idea that white people had to protect themselves physically against the threat of black danger, the threat that black people will overwhelm white people.
The government used swart gevaar to stoke fear in the masses as a tool to help maintain its power and justify its racist apartheid policies. One of those racist policies was the pass system. Basically, black people were forced to carry a pass at all times, something that said who they were, where they came from, and it also indicated whether that person had permission to be in urban areas and other places where white people lived.
That entire system was premised on the idea that black people living in close proximity to white people represented a danger. So swart gevaar would be invoked by the police officer who is looking at your pass as a black person and either permitting you or not permitting you to come into this white neighborhood.
The government also used swart gevaar as a reason to strengthen its borders against other African countries.
There was a fear that was played up in the South African press and by the white minority government that said, if we do not take swart gevaar seriously, then our borders, they will just march in.
Around election time, both the government and the media played up this fear all the more. Remember, black people couldn't vote. So for the white nationalists to remain in power, all they needed to do was sway the rest of the white population.
In the run-ups to elections, you would find increases in stories about violence, increases in stories about terrorism, increases in stories about frightening figures like the African National Congress, Nelson Mandela's party.
That's Nikki Falkoff.
What these stories do is they construct an imaginary, mythical figure of threat that becomes so powerful. And these stories, these ideas of who was scary, were pumped through the airwaves, through the national broadcasters, into the living rooms of anxious white people. It's perpetuated by editors of newspapers, by politicians, by policemen, by schools, by all sorts of people in positions of power who continue to pump and present this myth so that white people are living in literal terror. And if you want to maintain your life, your lifestyle, your privilege, your safety, but also if you want to maintain the civilized nature of the country in which you were born, you have literally no choice but to vote for the National Party. And this was used so effectively that the National Party just won landslide after landslide after landslide.
After apartheid ended, South Africa installed a democracy and elected Nelson Mandela as president. They started talking about building this rainbow nation, a place where people of all races could coexist. But utopia wouldn't come so easy. For one, crime was rampant. Now, this is obviously another complex issue. There was a lot happening in South Africa around this time. The country was still recovering from apartheid, a very violent period, and the criminal justice system was overwhelmed. But there was also this.
Apartheid created a generation of people with very few economic opportunities, and it brutalized them. So in that environment, it's very hard to imagine what other options people would have other than to steal, to get by, other than to voice their anger through violence.
Obviously, after oppressing the majority of the population for more than four decades, apartheid had created vast socioeconomic inequality, a huge gap between the haves and the have-nots. And home break-ins, like the ones Pistorius described on the witness stand, became a common occurrence.
Residents here say there's been a spike in robberies, with people being targeted inside their homes, and in some cases, firearms are used, often with deadly consequences.
The case of the Glen Vista couple south of Johannesburg, who reportedly shot and killed two armed robbers in the early hours of this morning.
Security became top of mind for everyone in South Africa. People across the country, black and white, started moving into homes that looked more like fortresses.
You walk down a street in Johannesburg in an elite area or a middle-class area, and you will see high walls on all houses. There will be barbed wire and or security, other security paraphernalia around the house. There'll be electric fences, and these fences make a ticking noise when a tree hits them. So you'll hear the sound of the suburbs in Joburg is like, from all the electric fences being set off. If you're in a particularly well-off area, there may be a security guard in a small hut who sits there all day, rain or shine, some poor dude in a hut, looking up and down the street. And as soon as something happens, he presses a button, and then his comrades arrive from the private security company with their huge guns.
Crime affected everyone, black and white alike. But some white people viewed it in racialized terms. They saw themselves as victims, and black people as perpetrators.
There's a way, a coded way, in which white people talk about violence as a black thing.
And as much as it's a problem, it's also something that feeds a narrative, a racialized narrative, that says, you know, black people will commit crime, and white people should be very fearful of this crime.
This was Swart Hawar, still playing out in post-apartheid South Africa. Here's Christy van der Westhuizen, the professor at Nelson Mandela University. She's written a lot about the Afrikaner people.
What we've actually seen with Afrikaners is that there's a transmission of those apartheid ideas around race and gender and sexuality and so forth. And that you frequently find younger people being as racist, sexist, homophobic as the older generation.
Remember, Oscar Pistorius comes from an Afrikaner background on his father's side of the family. His mother is not Afrikaner, but Sheila Pistorius seemed to be influenced by certain Afrikaner ideas. Like, she had this deep fear of intruders, and she seemed to pass that on to her son.
She made him, as a young man, very conscious of crime, that they would be attacked or that there had been break-ins at their home.
That's Andrea Johnson, the prosecutor.
So Oscar grew up in a reality that an Afrikaans boy would grow up in. So he was no different. So the fact that he had all of those examples were not surprising at all. For him and his late mom, those were real fears that they lived in, you know, to the point where they were actually paranoid.
Sheila Pistorius also imparted other life lessons to her son. For instance, she wanted him to be tough. She wanted him to fend for himself. Pistorius often cited the lessons he learned from his mother as he rose to fame as a Paralympian. And he made sure to mention it on the witness stand, too.
I come from a family where we were taught that we don't come, you know, cry to our parents at the end of the day. So I remember a situation where my buttons got torn off my shirt. Stood up for myself and I got into a physical altercation with this other kid. And when I got called in, my mother said to the headmaster that she doesn't think that it's wrong for her kids to stand up for getting bullied. And she gave the shirt to the kid's parents and told them to bring it back when it was repaired.
When the time came, Pistorius' mother sent him to Pretoria Boys High School. It's an incredibly elite all-boys school. And its alumni include politicians, judges, and professional athletes. All you need to know is Elon Musk went there.
It is an environment in which there is what Americans would call hazing, where boys go through all kinds of sort of physical taunts in order to prove that they are, you know, the cool kids. Regardless of whether you're a black boy or a white boy in South Africa, you are raised in a way that is really focused on an idea of toughness, of machismo. It really is a toxic culture.
Gerard Labuschagne was a police psychologist who worked on Pistorius' case, and he went to Pretoria Boys High too, albeit many years before Pistorius did.
It's almost Lord of the Flies. You get kids bullying. Perhaps some kids were a little bit sadistic and obviously took it too far. My parents were living in the United States at the time, so I came from the States with my American accent, short little chubby kid, into that environment, and you know, it was not easy. I was teased about my accent, about my weight. For some people, that breaks them down. Some people, it makes them stronger. That is that very sort of boys' school thing.
In his autobiography, Pistorius mentioned one experience he had in the dorms early on in his time there. One night, he woke up to someone shouting and saw flames all around him. He reached for his prosthetic legs, which he usually kept at the foot of his bed, and they weren't there. He wrote, "I was almost in tears, terrified that I was going to be left to die, when suddenly, the fire magically disappeared, and the boys came running back in laughing. They had apparently sprayed some steel cupboards with lighter fluid and set them aflame. The fire may have looked real, but it soon put itself out. The boys said it was their way of welcoming him, and Pistorius appeared to shrug off the incident. But this was all part of his ongoing education." As Pistorius became an adult, all of these lessons seemed to remain top of mind. He bought a home in Pretoria, located in a gated community. It's the type of place with security that patrols the neighborhood. His house also had an alarm system. And at night, he kept a gun near his bed. From what I've been told, owning a gun is also part of Afrikaner culture. It's tied to their idea of masculinity. Afrikaner men often like to hunt. But guns serve another purpose as well. Here's Nikki Falkoff again.
Every good Afrikaans man needs to have a gun. It's not an irresponsible thing to do. It's a responsible thing to do because you never know when it might become necessary. This is a necessary tool for you to keep your family safe because the ravenous, ravaging, uncivilized hordes are everywhere and we never know when they're going to attack.
In order to deal with that fear, they arm themselves because that is their sense of security.
That's Andrea Johnson.
So for them to protect themselves against black me, they need a gun because that is the one thing that can safeguard them. That is the one thing that is surely able to keep distance physically between us if an incident or the necessity arises.
Pistorius' father, Hank, essentially admitted this was the family's line of thinking in an interview he gave shortly after Valentine's Day 2013. Members of the Pistorius family reportedly owned 55 guns between them. 55 guns! And Hank told told a reporter that some of the guns were for hunting, but some were for protection. This is the actual quote. It speaks to the ANC government. Look at white crime levels. Why protection is so poor in this country. It's an aspect of our society. You can't rely on the police. Not because they are inefficient always, but because crime is so rife. As soon as the comments came out, people called them racist. I reached out to Hank Pistorius and asked for an interview, but he declined. At the time of Riva's death, Oscar Pistorius owned at least one gun, but he brought it everywhere he went. He had it on boats, riding in cars with friends. Remember that story of him firing the gun through the sunroof of a moving car? There was another incident that emerged too. In January 2013, Pistorius went out to eat with a group of friends. Sitting in a crowded restaurant, he asked to see his friend's gun. And as Pistorius handled the gun under the table, it accidentally went off. I asked Gerard Labuschagne, the police psychologist, what he thought of Pistorius as a gun owner. Labuschagne is a licensed firearm collector himself.
There's no way on earth you should ever be asking to see someone's firearm in a crowded restaurant. I mean, that is just absolutely unacceptable. You know, firing a shot through your sunroof of your vehicle is absolutely irresponsible and unacceptable. So for me, I just see him as a reckless gun owner. I mean, he's exactly the kind of guy who should not have a firearm. I would not want to be on a shooting range with someone who has that kind of mentality and attitude.
Part of that mentality was Pistorius seemed too eager to use his gun at a moment's notice. Remember the story he told Michael Sokolov, the New York Times Magazine journalist? One night, Pistorius thought there might have been someone in his house, and he'd gone to inspect with his gun at the ready.
In his telling of that story, him walking down the stairs, I assume in the dark, with a gun in his hand, I think that that's something that he possibly enjoyed. Oscar saw himself as like an action figure, a superhero, in every aspect of his life. When you look at Oscar's hobbies, you see the action figure Oscar. He drove speedboats at high speeds and drove his car very fast. He kept, you know, exotic animals and dangerous animals in a private zoo.
In that context, Pistorius seemed to treat guns as if they were another one of his toys. During the trial, the prosecution played a video of Pistorius at a gun range. He fires at a watermelon as someone cackles in the background. Pistorius compares the watermelon to a brain and calls the gun a zombie stopper, as if this were a video game. Here's Andrea Johnson again.
I think he appeased his mind by saying, because of the society I find myself in, I am allowed and I will have a gun. And I think he just got used to having a gun. And I also think it just made him feel like much of a man. He was very insecure, and you wouldn't glean that from the public persona, but I think that made him feel like much of a man.
Before he killed Riva, Pistorius wanted to stock up on even more guns. He'd taken steps to acquire about a half dozen more firearms. The list included revolvers, shotguns, and an assault rifle. Not only that, the gun near his bed was loaded with ammunition that expands upon impact to cause maximum damage. This was the type of bullet that Pistorius shot 4 times through the bathroom door. After Pistorius fired those 4 shots, this is what he said happened next.
My ears were ringing, I couldn't hear anything. So I kept on shouting for Riva to phone the police. I was still scared to retreat because I wasn't sure if there was somebody in the toilet.
Pistorius said he started walking towards the bedroom. All the while, he was calling out for Riva.
There was no one responded to me. At that point, I lifted myself up onto the bed and I placed my hand back to the right-hand side of the bed and I looked. I felt if Riva was there and I couldn't feel anything. I think it was at that point that it first dawned upon me that it could be Riva that was in the bathroom or in the toilet. I made my way back to inside the inside the bathroom, and I walked up to the bathroom door. I tried to grab the handle and rip open the door, push the door open, and it was locked. I ran back to the room. I opened the curtains. I shouted from the balcony, screamed, "Help, help, help." I screamed for somebody to help me.
Pistorius said he tried kicking down the door, and when that didn't work, he ran back to the bedroom and grabbed his cricket bat. He hit the toilet door with it 3 times until a plank of wood came off. Then he leaned in and unlocked the door.
And I sat over Reva and I cried. And I don't know how long I was there for. She wasn't breathing.
There was no intruder. There was never an intruder. More after the break. Stay with us. As Pistorius sat on the witness stand, he was asking the court and the public to believe that this was all a terrible accident, that he thought there was an intruder in his house, and he had no idea he was shooting at Reva through that locked door. And some people believed him.
If you close your eyes and you think of his story and you role play it in your head, it makes a lot of sense.
A reasonable man in exactly those same circumstances, facing danger, who had to protect himself, might have done it.
There was a sense among a lot of white Afrikaners that it was a tragic mistake that anyone could have made.
Nikki Falkoff again.
Because any of us would have been justified in taking that response if we had thought that there was a scary black guy in our house who was going to do us harm. It would have been perfectly acceptable for us to shoot him.
Andrea Johnson says the prosecution encountered people like that right from the start.
We took a lot of criticism because people felt that we should never have prosecuted him in the first place. It was an absolute accident. And the likes of Oscar Pistorius should never have seen the inside of a courtroom. And all we were doing is besmirching him. We had blackened his name no end. I remember the one morning we were walking to court and we walked past an Afrikaans woman and her daughter. She said some really scathing things in Afrikaans to Harry. You know, how dare he and who the hell does he think he is to even think that he can prosecute Oscar Pistorius.
Harry Nell is a white Afrikaner man too.
People who had talked to him for years just stopped talking to him. He had partners whose wives, when they walked up to greet him, the females would just not greet him. And the husbands would say, "I'm so sorry, but my wife feels you've betrayed us by prosecuting Oscar."
But some would say the Afrikaners were in the minority here. The majority of South Africans appear to back the prosecution. They didn't buy Pistorius' story, including many of the people we spoke to for this podcast.
I believe that Oscar Pistorius killed Reva Steenkamp because they got into a lover's tiff and he had real issues of anger.
Reva probably confronted him and challenged him and actually stood up for herself.
And I think that night he just saw red and was unable to stop himself.
Many people believe that now, on the witness stand, Pistorius was trying to save himself, using Swart Havar to shift the blame under the racist stereotype of the mythic black intruder. Here's Sasanke Umsamong again.
I'm not sure that he was making his thinly veiled racialized accusations in any sort of conscious way. I think what happens in South Africa is that the way that race operates is it's always there operating at a subliminal level, at an unconscious level. And so I think what we see Oscar doing is not a conscious attempt to blame black people, but certainly an attempt that arises from the fact that he has grown up as a white privileged young man who is surrounded by narratives of blackness. And he understands full well that if he's going to have any way out of this, then the best way is to make sure that there is a black person, even if they are imagined, who takes the fall.
It was up to the prosecution then to prove that Pistorius never thought there was an intruder in his house, that this was fiction and Pistorius made it up. One way to do that was to discredit Pistorius' version of events. And there seemed to be some pretty obvious flaws with it. How did he not see or hear Reva get up from the bed? Why hadn't he checked on her before approaching the bathroom? Why hadn't she responded when he asked her to call the police? And why had she locked the toilet door? On the stand, Pistorius tried answering these questions. He said the room was dark, the fans were blowing in his face, and he'd had his back turned at the most unfortunate times. He said he was fixated on confronting this intruder, and apparently assumed Reva was still in bed. And he said maybe Reva was scared too, with him shouting at this imaginary intruder, and maybe that's why she didn't respond to him when he called out for her to phone the police. He said that's why she must have locked the door too. Nevertheless, Harry Nell pressed on. He interrogated Pistorius for hours on the tiniest details of his story.
He would change his versions. I think at one stage, Harry asked him, okay, so which one is it? Is it the sixth version or the seventh version or the whichever version?
Pistorius stumbled at times, but he never wavered on the fact that he thought there was an intruder in his house that night.
In another society, the idea that you might shoot at someone from a closed door because it'd broken into your house would sort of defy credulity. People would be like, wow, well, that's a really excessive response, a disproportionate response. In South Africa, what Oscar Pistorius is banking on is that that idea makes sense, because it makes sense in a racialized environment in which Black people are always, quote unquote, breaking into your house. Black people need to be defended against at all costs. And so in the moment that he makes that claim, he loses a very large support base of those Black South Africans who were cheering him on in London and seeing themselves reflected in him. That quickly begins to disappear.
At the height of his athletic career, Pistorius had united the people of South Africa, people of all races. Now, he was driving them apart. All of this showed that, perhaps, South Africa still had lots of healing left to do. And the Rainbow Nation that Mandela spoke of in the mid-90s was still a ways off.
The hope that we held back then was this sense that it was possible to create a society in which people could live freely and in which they could achieve their dreams. That was the hope. And what we have realized in the last 25 years is that the legacy of apartheid has made that impossible. So what we wanted to do was skip ahead to the dream. And what we didn't do was take enough time to dismantle the psychological, social, and economic effects of apartheid. We were so busy focusing on building utopia that we didn't go back and dismantle the horror of the system that we had inherited.
And to this day, there are still a lot of people who defend him. He was just trying to look after himself, and protect his woman. And what it really does is it shows how powerful the frightening figure of the Black intruder is, and how that's one of the strategies, one of the tactics that we use in this country to not have to think about male on female violence. This was completely a distraction from the main issue of violence against women.
A complete distraction from the question everyone wanted answered. Did Oscar Pistorius kill Reva Steenkamp on purpose? Would he be convicted of murder?
Even if there's an intruder in your house, it's not okay to shoot through a closed door when you know there's a human being on the other side of it.
Discussions like these carried on throughout the trial. Everyone seemed to have an opinion, but there was only one person whose opinion truly mattered: the judge. She, and she alone, would decide Pistorius' fate. We'll get into that next time on False Idol. False Idol is written and reported by me, Tim Rowan, and produced by Timothy Liu Lee. Kate McAuliffe is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Devin Manzi, and our production assistant is Megan Coyle. Michael Garofalo is our editor. Matt Giles fact-checked the series. And this episode was mixed by Sandra Lopez-Monsalve at PRX Productions. Gautam Chopra, Amit Sankaran, and Adam Schlossman are our executive producers. Special thanks to Jessica Popovac, Joan Neeson, Ben Baskin, and Iggy Monda for their editorial support. And to composer Michael Kramer. If you like the show, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you do your listening. False Idol is a production of Religion of Sports and PRX. And if you or someone you know are experiencing domestic abuse, help is out there. Call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233. Or visit thehotline.org.